Raymond Zimmerman v. City of Eau Claire. Mr. Levy.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Lovey. I'm joined by Russell Ainsworth. Together we represent Evan Zimmerman, and Mr. Zimmerman, through us, is here to ask this court to grant him a trial. The evidence in this case was sufficient to have overcome summary judgment, and the district court should not have summarily dismissed the claim. Mr. Zimmerman spent 4 years in prison, lost his job, a hell of prison of being an ex-police officer in prison, suffered a stroke, all for a crime he had absolutely nothing to do with. It should have been enough for...
I don't know that, of course.
Well, we sure do for summary judgment purposes, Your Honor. He says, I didn't do it, and the district court should have granted him that inference. We also have the DNA evidence, which, while not technically constituting a videotape of what happened, it all points to an unidentified person. There's scrapings from underneath her fingernails, there's pubic hairs from her sweater, there's hairs on her jeans, all pointing to someone other than Zimmerman. And despite his manifest innocence,
possible.
I guess I have to concede, Your Honor, we'll never know who killed Kathy Morgan. But we would like the opportunity to argue to a jury that with the inferences in Mr. Zimmerman's favor, he didn't do it, and that somehow the defendant officers managed to find two witnesses who many, many, many months after the fact somehow came to implicate Mr. Zimmerman. And those facts, Your Honors, state not just one, but two independent Newsom claims, starting first, of course, with Maureen Horn. Her contemporaneous account is not only exonerating, but it says absolutely nothing incriminating about Mr. Zimmerman. 4 months go by. She then goes into a room with Detective Larson. She comes out of that room 4 months later. And now, for the first time...
You mean she was in the room 4 months?
No. She went 4 months with saying...
Her initial statement is exonerating.
Well, Your Honor, it's not so much that the initial statement is exonerating, it's that they're trying...
Cut beyond that.
They're trying to use...
Along with his manifest innocence.
They're trying to use her subsequent account as incriminating. In fact, that's
right,
the only evidence...
Of course.
But that's the only evidence they have against them.
I don't understand you. People change their minds, they recall things, they think they recall things. Police are entitled to rely on subsequent evidence as well as on contemporaneous evidence.
We have no direct proof of what happened in that room, Your Honor. But we do know that he didn't say to Maureen Horn that she got strangled before anybody knew that. And we do know
He's very upset, and he says she's been disemboweled. It's, you know, really goofy stuff. And sure, it casts suspicion on him. That's natural. Then later she says he said she'd been strangled, so...
Well, Your Honor, what I'd ask the court to assume here is that Mr. Zimmerman didn't say it, because for summary judgment purposes, he said he didn't say it. And 4 months later, after she had initially said A, she comes with version B.
You can't get a trial just because someone has had the charges dropped against him and says that, you know, everyone else is lying.
Well, Your Honor, I concede that.
You need evidence that the police were acting in a, you know, completely irresponsible fashion.
Your Honor, I think we've met what this court has required of a plaintiff to prove a Newsom claim. There, obviously, that is the legal standard this court has laid down. You have to prove that a witness was manipulated in a way that wasn't disclosed to the criminal defendant. It happens behind closed doors. It's necessarily a circumstantial thing. In this case, we have two witnesses who met a long time without saying anything incriminating. Then they meet with some detectives who have a strong motive at this point to make Zimmerman guilty, because they have focused on Zimmerman to the exclusion of everybody else. They then come out of the room, and the witnesses say something that's not only incriminating, but they say something that's false. And I guess that's a key point of my argument here, Your Honor. Bryce Reaney did not see Kathy Zimmerman, someone with shoulder-length brown hair, in her 30s, driving around in that van. Yet he somehow managed to come up with the exact details. Maureen Horn did not hear Zimmerman say that the victim had been strangled before anybody else knew that.
Yet I didn't know that. I don't understand you.
Well, Mr. Zimmerman testified.
That's not right.
I believe it is, Your Honor. With due respect, Mr. Zimmerman said, I did not say that to Maureen Horn. For purposes of summary judgment, that testimony should be credited. Yet Maureen Horn, 4 months after the fact, comes out of a room with Larson and says, I'm going to change my story. Now,
but the police are entitled to, they're not bound by his denials. The police can say, well, all right, she changed her testimony and or changed her recollection, and we're going to go with their current recollection. What's wrong with that?
Well, you know, I've made my argument. We also have the written statement. She testifies under oath. I gave a statement in February. When was it? The 26th or the 27th in writing. That statement's gone. That, Your Honor, would suggest that something exculpatory has been withheld. And this is not like one little piece of the evidence. This is the whole case against Zimmerman. There is nothing else tying him to this murder.
Well,
nothing else proves.
Obsession with her, of course, and well, you know, jealousy and so on.
You can't be convicted for being a good suspect. The only substantive.
No, of course not, but it's not an accident that the police focused on him.
No, it's not, Your Honor. It, you know, they had a hypothesis that he was their man.
Yeah, it was plausible, and they
absolutely
look for evidence to support it, and they mm-hmm find some, not the greatest evidence, but I don't see why you think they were trying to frame him.
Your Honor, they didn't find any. That's the point. Many months
they
went
did
by.
They, after many months, they found what they thought was enough evidence.
Well, they went back to the well, and they found two people who originally said nothing incriminating, and they
what's
somehow.
What's wrong with that?
Well,
subsequent interrogation of witnesses is pretty normal.
Sure, Your Honor.
They go back two or three times, sometimes five or ten. The question is not whether or not they were absolute, but whether or not there was sufficient evidence they gathered to present to a jury against Zimmerman, and that's what they presented.
Let's talk about it in terms of the second witness, Mr. Reaney. Mm-hmm. His first account is, I was driving to work, maybe I saw a white van, I don't even know what day. By the time he's ready for trial, he says...
That's a splendid cross-examination of him during the trial itself.
Your Honor...
Prior inconsistent statement. But it doesn't mean that the police set him up and talked him into doing it.
It wasn't a prior inconsistent statement, Your Honor. His first statement was, I don't know what I saw. At trial, he says, I saw, he nails the hairstyle.
That's a prior inconsistent statement.
That's true. Yeah. You know, he nails the hair color, he nails the hairstyle, yeah, he nails the age.
That's a prior inconsistent statement.
And before he knew nothing.
Yeah.
And in this case, what was withheld is what in Newsom they called the means by which they were able to induce the witness. He came out of a room, out of a car ride in his case, 3 hours with the detective. All of a sudden, he's got all the details. The Manning case, which Your Honor, I believe, authored, was an argument that I participated in. They fed the snitch the details, and then the snitch was used. Mr. Reed was not a snitch.
The question is, there's nothing here that indicate they fed him anything. They interrogated him a second time.
Well, if we're going to use circumstantial evidence, there is something
here.
You
seem to think that any time a witness changes his testimony, there must be police misconduct.
Yeah. We would not ask the court to so hold. But there also can be...
That's the implication of your argument.
There also has to be cases when something is extreme enough that even though we don't know, we weren't in the room, when they come out of the room, they're saying something so dramatically different and they're inserting details that they could not have known, that we're willing to suspend the requirement that there must be direct proof. There is meaning to circumstantial proof. And this case is far, far, far closer to that. It couldn't be any stronger. You know, Newsom said you can state a claim if a witness has been manipulated and has been fed details, and then later the police deny it. This case is not asking for an extension of law. This case is asking for an application of that law.
He'd have been in better shape if he had had a second recantation and said, yeah, they made me do it or they talked me into it.
But, in Your Honor,
that's not
granted.
There.
But I don't believe this court has ever held that you need that to get to trial.
Yeah, I doubt seriously whether you get past a directed verdict, but then there you go. Go ahead.
Your Honor, and it comes down to circumstantial proof under what the argument that the court is espousing. You could never prove a criminal conspiracy, for example, because you would have to rely on circumstantial proof. We believe that there is strong enough circumstantial proof in this record.
Circumstantial proof is that they change your mind on the second time around.
It's that they said something that wasn't incriminating, so much time went by, and then they said something incriminating the second time. But also, Your Honor, that the part they said the second time was false and was details that they could not have known had they not been fed, because the story...
Unless they read the newspapers.
The new incriminating story, Your Honor, was both false and unknown to them.
Well, did you depose them, these witnesses?
Your Honor, the witnesses, yes, and the witnesses are now saying we were not manipulated. Of course, we had the expert testimony that says that someone can be manipulated without their subjective awareness. The defendants are silent on that.
Yeah, but for a jury to agree with you, it would be just speculation, right? They'd have to... You don't have anything.
That's our most fundamental disagreement, Your Honor.
Suspicion that they may have been manipulated. That's all you have.
Speculation?
No evidence.
I disagree strongly, Your Honor. We have strong circumstantial evidence.
It's not strong. No, it's just a possibility.
I don't imagine how it could be stronger, Your Honor, in terms of
you
circumstantial evidence.
How it could be stronger?
For four months, you've lost
perspective, Mr. Levy.
For four months.
You can't imagine how you could have a stronger case.
If I could put it in the terms...
Showing lack of imagination or something. Some problem.
For 4 months, the witness says nothing incriminating. Detective Larson was a strong motive.
Well, for 4 months, nobody asked him either.
Well, she says she was asked right away, and she gave a contemporaneous account.
Right. That one she did. And 4 months later, she came up with a different story.
And the police say they didn't ask her again, but she said they came by like every day, and they kept asking me questions about it, about what Zimmerman said. The inferences keep getting drawn against us, and that's improper. She said they kept coming back every day, a dozen times, and asking me. Her only connection to the case. Her only connection to the case is what Zimmerman, this conversation she supposedly had with Zimmerman. She says we had multiple conversations, there's no dispute. 4 months later, she comes out of a room, and now she's saying something that's not only incriminating, but is also false.
I think you make a splendid argument for a finding of not guilty in terms of the criminal trial, but I'm concerned about the present action is against the policeman that they can hive up a story and get somebody to talk about, and that's different.
Well, what we're asking is for the inferences to be drawn in our favor, and we're asking to present it to a jury of Mr. Zimmerman's peers and ask them if they're willing to draw the inferences that we think are fair from the evidence.
And if I understand what you're asking.
I think it's appropriate, Your Honor. I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Levy. Mr. Pollan?
May it please the Court, my name is Raymond Pollan, and I'm here today representing Officers Adams, Foster, Larson, and the City of Eau Claire. After briefing an argument in the case, the plaintiffs agree that there was no policy, practice, and custom of creating any claim against the municipality. They've agreed that there are no state law claims based on the procedures for notice, statutes of limitations. As to the individual officers then, Larson, Foster, and Adams, they agree now, after having gone through the briefing process, that there was probable cause to arrest him. And based on the briefing, they also agree that malicious prosecution case under the Constitution can't stand. So what's left? What's left is their claim that each of these three officers failed to disclose material and exculpatory evidence. At summary judgment, they were required to come forth with facts and not speculation. The Abrams case from this court in 2002 was a similar case involving malicious prosecution. The court said speculation will not carry the day in carrying the burden of proof on summary judgment. You've got to have something more. Now, we've done dozens and dozens of depositions in this case. There have been tens of thousands of documents that were produced, the police record, the DA's records. And in the end, what they're relying upon to try to make their case is that information that they pulled from the police file was something that was failed, that the police failed to disclose to the attorney in the criminal case. District Attorney White acknowledged that he had an open file policy and that all of the documents that the police created were available for review and in fact were reviewed.
Mr. Pollan, there were some questions, though, were there not, as to whether the police had generated all of the material they should have generated and put it in the prosecutor's file. Isn't that the problem?
Well, I don't think so, because the evidence has been that everything that they created was put in the file.
But apparently there were no interview notes from the subsequent visits, for instance, to Ms. Horn, and they simply didn't turn up. Can't we draw an inference? Couldn't the court draw an inference from the lack of those of interview notes from all those visits?
I don't think so. Maureen Horn was interviewed on February 26th, and in that interview, she may or may not have used the word strangle. That's the big issue in this, that somehow she came back 4 months later and used the word strangle. She was interviewed on that day, and there was a report created regarding that contact. She was interviewed the next day, not having to do with whether the word strangled was used or not, not having to do with her contact with Zimmerman. She was interviewed on the next day about her friendship with Mr. Zimmerman. What were his problems with drinking? What were his romantic contacts with Thompson? That was the second contact. The third and fourth contact were two phone calls that Maureen Horn made to the police department. In one call, she said, you know, Zimmerman called me and told me he knew who killed Kathy Thompson. In a second phone call, she called them up to say, you know, I talked to Mr. Zimmerman, and he told me he thinks that Kathy Thompson had been raped. Those were the four contacts. Then, in June, which was a couple of months later, Detective Larson went to Ms. Horn's house to reconcile two statements because there was a question between the officers of where she had been interviewed. They went back to her and spoke with her about that, and in discussing the matter, Maureen Horn mentioned the word strangle. Larson said, you've never said this before. It's not in any of the prior reports. And Maureen Horn says, well, he said it. And Larson said, well, we'd better put this into a report. And they put that into a written statement. Now, the claims that have been made that there were other contacts and other reports that somehow turn up in the file are, first of all, based on speculation, and second of all, based on what I believe is an attempt to mislead the court on what the record is in the case. Maureen Horn testified during the trial, and they asked her, did you give a written statement? She said, yes. Did you give a written statement in February? She said, yes. And then there were questions because she was obviously confused. In fact, if you read the transcript, which is part of the record, the criminal court judge inserts himself into the process and says, why didn't you just ask her if she did more than one report? And she says, I did one report or one statement, and it was clarified that she was nervous, and when she said the report was in February, it was really in June. That's what they're piling on to say. This is the issue that there's some kind of report that was made and destroyed. Maureen Horn never testified to that. When you look at the testimony as a whole, she testifies she did one report, and they also make hay to say that Maureen Horn testified that there were dozens of contacts and no reports for that. That's not in the record. They asked Maureen Horn, did you have contacts with the police? And she said, oh, I saw them dozens of times. In follow-up examination, they said, did you really see them dozens of times? How many times did you see them? She said, well, I'm not sure. I don't recall how many times. And that's the second thing where they say there were many visits and many reports. This wasn't an example like they're trying to suggest that they kept going back to Maureen saying, say something. We're going to put you in a room until you say the word strangle. That didn't happen. There were, in fact, three face-to-face contacts, two of them initiated by her by phone, and in that conversation, she mentioned, the last of them, she mentioned the word strangle. How do we know that she said the word strangle? Because Larson documented it in his report. And Larson documented this had never been said before. This is a significant issue because she hadn't said it before. She remembers it now, and they documented that. So to say that this is a fabrication is just, it's a sad statement. In fact, in their reply brief at page 10, they acknowledge that there is no evidence that anyone at any time was coerced. So, again, to try to build something on that, again, is inconsistent with the record, and it's just plain wrong. They mentioned the DNA evidence, and first coming right out of the gate, that the DNA all points to one person. That is false. The DNA does not point to one person. There was DNA evidence from the fingernail scrapings underneath Kathy Thompson's fingers, which may have indicated two different persons. Neither of them were Evan Zimmerman. There was a hair found on her pants that was not tested and shown to be Mr. Zimmerman. They never were able to test and tie up those DNA evidence to anyone else because they never identified a witness for whom there was a likelihood that they could get a DNA sample from and then compare it up. So to say it all pointed to one person, it's just simply inconsistent with the record. And to suggest that was withheld on that basis is wrong. The plaintiffs allege that there's circumstantial evidence and that the case ought to proceed on that basis. Well, circumstantial evidence is one thing, but pure speculation is something else. In preparing for the oral argument before the court today, I read all of the cases that we cited, which is always more of a burden than I think when I'm writing the brief. But the three cases for summary judgment that people always cite to you are Celotex, Anderson, and Mitsubishi. In the Mitsubishi case, I had forgotten this, but Mitsubishi case was a conspiracy case. It was a conspiracy on price fixing, and it came to the court on summary judgment, and the court looked at that and said that allegations and theories alone are not enough. In a conspiracy case, at some point, you've got to come forward with facts. And In that case, there were no facts, and the court dismissed it on summary judgment. It was affirmed in the higher courts, and I would submit to you that for this case, that should be the same result, and that the district court decision dismissing the case should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pollan. Any further? Do you represent additional police officers?
Yes, Your Honor.
You're Mr.
Cavelli.
Mr. Cavelli?
Yes, I think I have 4 minutes. I represent Mr. Trapp, who was brought into the case very late, has very little involvement in the case, I think was mentioned only in 2 pages of appellant's brief, was not mentioned in the argument. What happened in this case was because he was brought in late, his motion for summary judgment was brought a month after the city and the other defendants. There is one conspiracy alleged. The district court, when it ruled on the city's motion, also ruled on Mr. Trapp's motion before the plaintiff responded to Trapp's summary judgment, saying there is one set of facts, there is one alleged conspiracy, there is one set of law, there is nothing new for Mr. Trapp, therefore I grant that motion. On their brief, they say, well, we might have had something new or different to say for Mr. Trapp. However, they have not come forward with anything either in the district court, and they didn't have to move, but if they wanted to show prejudice that they did, in fact, have something new, that there was something they really had separate and apart for Trapp, they could have brought a motion to reconsider, submitted that information, and put it before the court.
Mr. Cavelli, there are some cases in this court that say that if the district court grants summary judgment prematurely, that is, before the party has a chance to reply, that the court is really, quote, without power, unquote, to grant the motion. What do you say about those cases?
I think we have a distinguishing fact, and that's set forth in Eichert, where you have a record, and there was an opportunity to respond to the city's motion and to all the legal issues and all the legal facts, and the court said, because those facts and law are the same, I am granting the motion. So I think that is an exception. And in Eichert, the court said, well, in that circumstance, in this case, Zimmerman comes forward with additional evidence to say, hey, no, I did have additional different information here, that they should do so and give this court something upon which it could say, hey, there was prejudice here in doing what the court did. But the trial court basically said, it's the same case, there's one conspiracy, it's the same set of facts. The other thing is the polygraph is kind of a false issue. First of all, they had no expert. The physiologic responses that they gave to their polygraph questions were recorded and available to them. They had no expert to say that it was scored improperly, let alone falsified. They had the data, the raw data, available to them. To say, well, Mr. Zimmerman says...
It wasn't used for any purpose, if I recall, at all.
It's not admissible. That's undisputed.
Well, it's admissible by agreement in Wisconsin, if I recall correctly. If both sides agree, it gets in, but nobody agreed.
That's correct.
And it wasn't offered anyway, so it doesn't have...
It could not be offered. I did a request to
admit... One of the reasons it's inadmissible is because it seems to be scientifically suspect. So it doesn't make any difference. If the guy comes up with a dopey answer, the answer is...
Some courts feel it suspects, some don't, but in Wisconsin it's clear, pursuant to the request to admission, that it is just not admissible for any purpose in the criminal proceeding. It was not offered in the criminal proceeding. The district attorney who charged said, I knew about it, but it made no difference. It played no role in my charging decision because I knew it was inadmissible and could not be used in any form or fashion in the criminal trial. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Cavelli. Mr. Hannon?
May it please the court, I'm Ed Hannon, and I'm representing William Shimbera, Mr. Zimmerman's criminal defense attorney in the first proceedings. I filed a motion to dismiss because plaintiff's brief has not challenged the district court's conclusions that a common law claim against a non-diverse defendant does not arise out of a common nucleus of operative fact with a claim by the defendant's client against the state for alleged intentional conspiratorial wrongdoing. This raises a very important Article III issue. What is the scope of the federal judicial power here in terms of adjudicating what is, in essence, a common law, state law claim against a non-diverse defendant? I suggest to the court that because that issue, a very important issue under Article III, 28 U.S.C. 1367 is to be construed so it is coterminous with Article III, that because that issue hasn't been raised and briefed, this court ought not consider it. And I respectfully suggest that when...
you can have a supplemental claim against a non-diverse defendant.
Does a supplemental claim against a common law claim against an attorney representing a criminal defendant for alleged negligence, not conspiracy, not aiding and abetting any wrongdoing of the state, no intentional conduct, does that arise out of a common nucleus of operative facts where, you know,
well,
for purposes
I suppose
of 1367?
What Mr. Zimmerman believes is that it was a combination of the conspiracy of the police officers and the incompetence of his lawyer that resulted in his languishing in prison for 4 years.
Well, perhaps.
That's related.
Perhaps, but my point, Your Honor, is that has not been briefed.
Mr. Hannon, some of our cases say all there needs to be is a loose factual connection. That's the wording of the cases. In order for it to amount to one case or controversy for these purposes, isn't there some loose factual connection here?
There's tangential factual connection, I suppose, yes. That's the language of the district court. However, also note that the district court found exceptional circumstances under 1367B. So now we have, in addition to the question of law, which I think to be very, very important, and one that ought not to be decided
you can
without
see
reading.
How much overlap there would be, right? Because this case, if it ever went to trial, would be a lot about trial tactics, what was done at trial, what was brought out, not brought out, and so on.
It could also judge.
So you could imagine if you had separate trials, the defendants in the two trials whipsawing each other, right? And saying, well, it was your lawyer should have gotten you off, right? And the lawyer saying, well, it was this police conspiracy that was responsible. So I think it makes sense for them to be consolidated.
I also suggest, Your Honor, though, that would raise a number of very, very difficult questions, jury instructions and the like. But in any event, the issue has not been briefed. And the law of this circuit, as I understand it, is that when you have an issue that's been raised but not commented on, not argued, no authority cited one way or the other, that this court routinely declines to consider those issues, and that's what I'm suggesting the court ought to do here.
So what is it you're asking for, I don't know?
A dismissal. I filed a motion to dismiss, and the order of the court was that my motion to dismiss would be considered by the merits panel directly.
Did you file a brief?
I filed just a motion, and the order of this court was that my motion would be considered and deemed my response brief, Your Honor.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Hannon. So, Mr. Levy, how much time does he have? 4 minutes?
Mr. Levy, what do you have to say to Mr. Hannon's argument that you really haven't raised this issue with respect to his client at all?
Your Honor, all we ask with respect to Mr. Chambera is if there's a remand, and I truly believe there should be one, that the district court be asked, would it make sense to try these two together? Judge Shabbat said no, but on the way back, we'd ask that the district court just be asked, should we try these together? And I believe we'd persuade the district court that it makes sense. But back on the merits, Your Honors, the argument that Mr. Zimmerman was, in fact, the victim of a violation of his constitutional rights, the one that I truly believe we should be making to a jury rather than to your honors, is that there was no evidence proving his guilt other than these two witnesses. And I think any fair or objective view of these two witnesses, it was goofy. The second witness was driving to work one day. They hit him at a roadblock 6 weeks later. And they say, did you see the white van? He's like, I don't know, maybe on that day, maybe not. By the time of trial, he puts on a tie and he says, I saw a woman in her 30s with short brown hair driving in that van. And he couldn't have seen it. His original account was it passed behind him. He couldn't have even seen the passenger. He's now moved it to in front of the van. He's now changed the time. He's now nailed the description of the victim perfectly. That's the only evidence that proves his guilt. That and Maureen Horn, a witness whose original account, when her memory was the freshest, said nothing about strangulation. Those two witnesses, a reasonable jury could find, would not have implicated Zimmerman but for misconduct by the police officers. And we're not asking this, Your Honors, to invent a new area of law. That is what Your Honor's case law says. That is the Newsom case. If you manipulate a witness and then withhold the means, the way Newsom puts it, is you prevent the criminal defense attorney from learning the means by how you induce those witnesses, then a jury should be able to decide. I wasn't in that room. No one was in the room. We will never have direct proof. But the story that Renee Bryce told after he got out of that car with that police officer after 3 hours is so dramatically different from I was driving to work one day and I might have seen a white van. And the story that Maureen Horn told over and over again, which is that she was strangled. And I want to talk about Maureen Horn because there are missing interview notes. If we're going to get the benefit of the doubt, you want to talk Celotex? She said they came by every day. That is her testimony. How many times? It wasn't a leading question. She said a dozen or more. He's telling you what he wants to argue into a jury in closing argument. Oh, don't believe that. The police will tell you exactly how many contacts there were. That is not what the record shows. She says she wrote a statement. When was it? Her words. In February. When day? She says February 26th or 27th. Counsel hangs his hat on. She's obviously confused. She only wrote one statement. Your Honors, I'd like to read you her testimony. Question. This is on page 241 of Exhibit 8 in Record 75. Did you write more than one statement? Witness, I don't remember. She didn't say she only wrote one statement. If we're going to apply Celotex.
She didn't say she wrote two either. So, you know,
she didn't. Said, yeah. But she did say, Your Honor, did you write your first statement? It was in February. It was on the 26th. That's not a random date. That's a contemporaneous statement. If we're going to get the benefit of the doubt, Your Honors, where is that statement? That's the statement that would have sprung him. It's not like there's a whole whirlwind. And, Your Honor, you know, you said, well, he had this obsession. If you want to give us the benefit of the doubt, he said, I didn't have an obsession. He said he was okay with the wedding. There was plenty of evidence going the other way. There is nothing tying him to this crime except these police officers managed to get two witnesses to tell stories that are way, way off. And we also have the other angle on the Renee Bryce thing. The Shefflin affidavit was before the district court. He was obviously, it was a suggestive, that's an independent due process violation. Your Honor said you can't imagine, you know, Your Honor disagreed with me when I said I can't imagine a stronger case for witness manipulation absent direct evidence. Obviously, if he's going to admit he got leaned on, then you got it. But absent that, Renee Bryce says, I don't know what I saw. And then by trial, he's nailing the description perfectly. He's changing the time. He's changing in front. And all that happened in between is that the defendant spent 3 hours in a car with him and fed him details that his memory would not have otherwise known. How could you get a stronger circumstantial case? We weren't there. We weren't in the car. Detective Adams won't answer the question. What'd you talk about in the car? He says, I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to just put up a big shield and say, I don't remember. He doesn't even commit perjury. He doesn't even deny that they talked about the facts. And then when he comes out of the car, he's telling a story that's the only evidence that ties Zimmerman to this crime. The DNA.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.